From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast. Dr. D. Subba Rao is an IIT graduate, IAS officer, PhD in economics, and a former governor of the Indian Central Bank, the Reserve Bank of India. While he's best remembered for his steady handling of the RBI during the 2008 global financial crisis, he was also an IAS officer in Andhra Pradesh and in the central government, which put him at the forefront of multiple major policy moves. He has a new book out titled Just a Mercenary, Notes from My Life and Career, which has been published by Penguin Random House. Unlike his first book that dealt more with his time in the RBI, this book documents the various events from his eventful life and the lessons he took away from them. In today's episode, we're in conversation with the soft-spoken Duvuri Subba Rao about various aspects of his book. Among the topics we discussed include the need for honesty among civil servants, why the independence of regulators matters, why governments in the country shouldn't be going to court over financial disputes, the 2G scam, and more. We started by asking him about his relatively unconventional choices in college and after clearing the IAS exams.
Dr. Subba Rao, I want to start with the fact that you got through IIT and the IAS, and in both cases, you kind of chose options which would be the relatively less popular ones, which is BSc, and instead of IFS, you chose IAS. How do you view the sort of clamor for it now that you see for these same very things that, you know, you write very calmly about it in the sense of getting through both of these institutions?
Yeah, I must say that I had the privilege of getting through both the IIT and the IAS. But I must say that both the IIT JEE and the civil service exam, as they call it now, have become much more competitive today than during my time. So it's much more difficult today for a candidate, a given candidate, the probability of success in the JEE or in the IAS is much lower than it was during my time. So it's much more difficult. And I made choices, as you said, less popular choices, which is correct in some sense, but life is a question of making choices all the time. I enjoyed studying physics, although I could have chosen an engineering discipline. I thought that the engineering is too specialized. With physics, I have the options. Beyond the IA, should I not make it? And the IIT Kharagpur was the only IIT offering a physics BSc honors at that time. I took that. When it came to the IAS, because I topped my batch, I had the option of going to the Foreign Service of the IAS. And I, in fact, wanted to very seriously go for the Foreign Service. But that was more a youthful, aspiration, rather than an informed choice. I believe that both the IAS and the IFS served the country well. We've had some outstanding IFS officers. I have no intention of belittling the Foreign Service, but I'm personally happy that I made the choice of going to the IAS, because one of the biggest charms of the IAS is the sheer variety of jobs that you can do while being in the same service. So I'm happy that I chose the IAS. I'm indeed happy that I chose to study physics.
A lot of your book also deals with probity. You talk of it across chapters. You've cited your own principles that you followed, and a lot of that is tough for anyone to follow, no matter what kind of position of power they're in, whether IAS, IPS, or in the private sector. What sort of guides that then? What should perhaps guide one's probity?
Probity is an absolute must, right? You should be adopting the highest standards of professional and pecuniary integrity, and you should be seen to be adopting the highest standards of professional and pecuniary integrity. Having made that statement, it is very difficult in real life to follow that to the T, because you're going to be tested many times. And where do you draw the line? For example, if you have a boss whose line of probity is rather thin, and you're following her or him, and it goes against your line, how do you manage the situation? Do you tell your boss that I'm getting away from here? Or you continue to follow her? You know, these are difficult situations, and I think you have to handle them depending on the situation. But two things I want to say. Absolute probity is a must, and everybody must learn to draw their own line and follow that.
You also talk of it from the point of view of IAS officers and things like that. Given corruption and even probity is really a spectrum, like you said, it is not the easiest thing to adhere to in some ways. There are degrees even within that. And something like state corruption is an eternal topic in India. How does one then ensure probity in, say, the government services, or in terms of, like, is an internal reporting mechanism the solution here? Like, how do we ensure that then?
Well, there is already this whistleblowing, some law for that and some rules about that. But I don't know to what extent that will work if whistleblowers are, first of all, not confident that they will be protected. Second, if whistleblowing is resorted to with a perverse incentive. You know, I've come across several instances in my career where absolutely straightforward officers came into difficulties or were got into problems because of organizational rivalries and enmities and all that, and false complaints were filed. That's always a hazard in the system. So the system should take care of that, and superiors should watch for that.
Also, you've seen two economic crises up close and personal. You've seen the 2008 one. You pretty much were in charge of that in some ways, handling the sort of India's response to it. And the 1991, where you were much more junior, but you were in the sort of front lines over there as well. What are the sort of lessons for you from seeing and handling two economic crises so closely?
Yeah, you know, at their core, both these crises as they manifested were similar, in the sense that 1991 was a balance of payments crisis. 2008 was a global financial crisis which had a knock-on impact on us. It turned into some sort, I wouldn't call it a crisis, but there was pressure on our balance of payments. There was also concerns about preserving financial stability. So the challenges were different. 1991, we were not integrated into the global economy. In fact, 1991 marked when we were a closed economy to an open economy, whereas by 2008, we had largely integrated into the global economy, both by way of trade and by finance. And handling them was required. But 2008 global financial crisis, where I was governor of the Reserve Bank, some of the lessons I learned from that were that central banks have to act in crisis times in a mode that is quite different from their normal pattern. Normally, central banks agonize quite a lot about decisions because they deliberate on that and they worry about whether the policy will deliver the intended outcomes. Because it does not, it will affect the credibility of the central bank. Whereas during crisis times, you have to let your standards down, do a number of things which you believe will have some positive impact, with the full knowledge that your chances of success will be lower, and you have to lower your standards a little bit. And crisis management is a percentage game. That's the first lesson I learned. And the second lesson is that some of the things that you do during a crisis time might come into conflict with long-term sustainability. For example, if you have a fiscal stimulus in order to preserve financial stability, you might end up with inflation later, as happened during 2008 crisis for us, and as is happening today around the world, in the US, in Europe. Part of the inflation is because of the short-term fiscal stimuli that those countries had implemented. So in crisis times, you have to draw the balance between short-term compulsions and the potential long-term implications of those. You've got to learn to do that. The third lesson I learned was about communication. In crisis times, policymakers, especially in the central bank, are enjoined to communicate, because markets are gripped with fear and panic, and central banks presumably have much broader knowledge of the financial system than individual institutions. So they must give guidance to the markets, not mislead them, not hold back anything, but in a positive sense, in a sense that will calm fears and panic and at the same time bring about stability.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of independence of the RBI aspect. With independent regulators, there is always the challenge of sort of ensuring that they are truly independent, because the appointees may be coming in from the legislative side. What is the importance of these institutions staying independent at perhaps all times, not just in crises, but at all times? Why does it matter so much?
Independence of regulators matters for the credibility of the economy and for the markets to function efficiently. Because if markets and financial market participants tend to believe that regulators are not acting independently, not acting in their best professional judgment, on the other hand, they are influenced by political bias or by considerations other than professional, the markets will get uncomfortable. And that is not good for the long-term growth and stability of the economy. I believe independence of regulators is necessary for the market to function efficiently and to deliver growth and prosperity.
If a regulator isn't independent, and maybe even the market is being blind to it, how do we know as the people that here we are looking at something that's fundamentally maybe not working the way it should?
Well, I can't reduce my answer to a formula, but if the large majority of people believe that this is what the economy demands at this point of time, and if the regulator is behaving differently, that is a big signal that the regulator is being motivated by considerations other than the larger public interest. I don't believe that there is a formula to discern that, but most learned and experienced commentators, media, economists will be able to discern that.
You also write a lot about your time in Andhra Pradesh as a civil servant. You write about how NTR as a chief minister brought a sort of balance to center-state relations at a time when it was heavily skewed in favor of the center. Could you talk about why that sort of balance matters in the Indian economic sense? Why is it not the best sense to have the power shifted higher towards the center than the sort of federal structure that it is?
Yeah, first about NTR, I must say that he campaigned on an anti-center platform. He believed that states must have more political, fiscal, and administrative autonomy. That was the center. That was the platform on which he rose to political eminence, and I believe he succeeded to a large extent. Even before NTR, there was MGR, etc. But NTR was the first chief minister or the political leader to campaign exclusively on an anti-center platform. He even said, in his own inadequate understanding, I should say, that the center is a myth. And he said, why does the central government need money? But those are extreme statements. But regardless, he rose to prominence on an anti-center platform. And I believe that for our political and economic system to function optimally, states must have autonomy, both in a political sense, as well as politics, administration, and economics. But there must be sufficient checks and balances to ensure that they don't go off track. Let me give an example, which is that state borrowing. States, of course, need to borrow in order to meet their expenditure commitments. But if states are left without any control, allowed to borrow as much as they want, it will affect the national financial stability, because our financial stability as an economy is a function of the combined fiscal stance of the center and states. Therefore, states collectively and individually have to be fiscally responsible. That is why there are some constitutionally instituted arrangements, like the center has to allow borrowing by states as long as the states are indebted to the center. And I believe those controls are important for stability, as I said, also because the market believes that state borrowing is implicitly guaranteed by the center. There is no such guarantee. But states are able to command a lower interest rate than what their actual fiscal situation would give, because the market believes that the center bails them out. So center has some responsibility. Therefore, I believe center also needs to have some control. And those controls have to be within limits.
Then how do you view the current scenario where you have states and the central government going to the Supreme Court at all times now over payments of all kinds, whether it is just the disbursal of funds, whether it is disaster funds and things like that?
No, that is entirely inadvisable. I don't think that those matters should be taken to courts, because courts do not have the expertise. They do not have the understanding of the practical fiscal situation. In any case, the judicial system must be handling questions which fall within the judicial realm. These are matters of politics and should be resolved by political understanding between the state government and the central government, between the chief minister and the finance prime minister.
So I have to then ask also about the 2G scam, since it's again a major chunk in your book. You write about how for a civil servant, the risk always is that you sign a file, it goes down the road and suddenly comes back and it's a major scam. Having seen the 2G scam, okay, the 2G case, let me rephrase that, and the fallout and everything since then, how do you view that in hindsight now?
First, let me say that the 2G scam or 2G case was just a very small part of my books. It's not a major chunk, said it. Okay, although the media has projected as if the entire book is 2G case. But it is true that as civil servants, you take a number of decisions and anything could be questioned. And it's possible to impute motives to any decision. So if civil servants are so careful that they're scared to sign any file, take any decision, because it might later on catch up with them, it'll harm the economy. That's not good for the economy. That's not good for efficient administration. So there should be sufficient comfort level for civil servants that if they take decisions in good faith, they'll be protected. But saying that is one thing, actually acting on that is another. Because every civil servant who is implicated in a case or scam or whatever feels that he or she is actually being victimized. It's difficult, but I just want to define the problem. You have to give confidence to civil servants that you, if you act in good faith, you'll be protected. And if you act in malafide, you will be penalized. And implementing that is difficult, but we should make greater efforts to give that comfort to civil servants.
But isn't that also a function of politics, really? Because, the government changes, everything suddenly becomes...
That is true. You know, that wasn't the case for much of my service. Increasingly, that is becoming the case, that politics are by definition cleavaged and civil servants are becoming cleavaged along political lines. You know, some civil servants, especially at the senior level, are seen as aligned with one political party. That is bad for the civil service, and because civil service is most efficient when it is neutral and is seen to be neutral. Unfortunately, as you point out, that value is eroding.
And you've seen the Indian state over a large spread of it. How would you view the changing of the Indian state between when you started as a young civil servant and now? What for you are the biggest changes that you see?
Well, from an IAS officer's perspective, I can say that. First, when I joined the service 50 years ago, our priority as administrators on the front line was poverty reduction. Today, the priority is, of course, poverty reduction, but poverty has come down much more. It is more about service delivery. There was much less awareness at that time, much greater awareness today, much less demand for accountability at that time, much greater demand for accountability today. Then there is technology has come in a big way. You know, when I was serving, you actually had to go and see, whereas today you have cell phones, you have internet, you have video conferencing, which is good, but I don't believe it is a substitute for actually going and seeing, experiencing the field situation. The other big difference I see is that when I joined the service, politicians, especially at the grassroots level, they had political roots, but on an average, they were not very highly educated compared to civil servants. Today, politicians, even at the grassroots level, are as educated, rival civil servants in terms of their educational qualifications and expertise. Some local level politicians even have PhDs. That's another big difference. Some civil servants used to look down, talk down to politicians. Today, they're at level. But some things have not changed, which is the commitment, integrity, professionalism required of the civil service.
What do you think is like a big misconception about the Indian state and the civil service that you feel is still existent in society in a sense?
You know, this opinion or stereotype is shaped by a minority about corruption or callousness, a lack of professional integrity or competence levels is shaped by a minority. But unfortunately, the public attributes, you know, paints with the same brush, which is par for the course. That is in the very nature of public view, that they extrapolate without seeing the differences. And I think it is up to the civil service to live down this negative reputation and decide that collectively we will act, individually we will act in the best interest of the government and best public interest, and we will set an example for the lower level government staff, because how top civil servants, especially in the IAS and IPS, behave and perform has an influence on the lower level bureaucracy.
How do you view then this sort of clamor for the government job that exists in the current day?
It is in part a reflection of employment or job opportunities outside the government. But it is also a reflection of the vast differences between a government job and a private job. Take a teacher, for example, in a primary school. A government primary school teacher gets paid as much as 5 times as a private school teacher, even though the private school teacher oftentimes delivers more, is asked to put in longer hours and is held to higher standards. And that is unfair. Even post-retirement benefits and social security that the government offers. So the attraction of government jobs is the security and the safety nets that a government job offers. For example, if you ask a person, a random person, a choice of a private job which pays 2 lakhs per month and a government job that pays 75,000 rupees per month, most people would be willing to trade that additional 1.25 lakhs of income for the security and social safety net that a government job offers. Of course, government servants, and they want even more. But I think politicians must realize that their obligation is to the larger public, and they can't keep on giving more and more to the government unless they take it away from others. There's an opportunity cost, and they must ensure that there is a balance.
What's your view of the economy as it stands? Because there's a lot of debate about that sort of K-shaped recovery, higher inequality, and a lot of these things find mention in your book, but not in a very direct sense. But yeah.
In any case, I can't capture my response to your very broad question in a minute or so. But economy is doing well in terms of growth. We clocked 8%+ year before last, 7.6% last year, probably 7% this year, and maybe 6.5 to 7% over the next 2-3 years. But a question, several questions. Can we maintain this momentum? What is the growth model that we must adopt to maintain this growth momentum? What is it that we must be doing to ensure that not only does the economy grow rapidly, but that we spread the benefits of growth more widely, that prosperity is more widely shared? How do we tackle unemployment and inequality? These are questions for the short term and the medium term. And indeed, there are other questions like, how do we deal with demographics? There are different demographic transitions taking place. They're going to change the global demand pattern. How do we handle that? How do we handle the impact of artificial intelligence and robotics, and what impact that might have on manufacturing and service exports from developing countries? We must worry about globalization and particularly about geopolitical tensions. We must worry about climate change.
Are these worries a lot more than they were earlier, or is this a continuous state of affairs?
No, no. Climate change, for example, 10 years ago, we were less anxious, not just in India, but even in the world. We were less anxious about climate change 10 years ago than today. Even demographics. You know, the narrative when I was a young civil servant used to be that our huge population is a problem, that as much as we're trying to deliver development, that's being neutralized by population growth. Today, that narrative has dramatically turned that our huge population is actually an advantage because India uniquely positioned with a young, large working population and declining fertility rate, without realizing that we can exploit what is called the demographic dividend only if we generate jobs.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh and Sahil Gupta. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on TOI Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, email us at toipodcast@timesinternet.in.